Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And on our way to the conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank, belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. So we will hear at some point in the course of this hour from Baynard Woods, who is at the press conference with Marilyn Mosby now, at the very site where Freddie Gray was arrested and injured and with all the charges being dropped, as we said earlier. So we'll talk a bit about that this course of this hour as well with our guests. As we hear more information coming in, we'll be doing this with some intensity tomorrow at 10 o'clock on the program. And we will also, and I'm sure tonight, Sean Yost will be somewhere between 5 and 7 tackling the subject with his guests and be talking about that here on the air as well in WEAA. And we'll be hearing more reports from Julius Wilson, our WEAA news director, keeping with updates as well. But when Baynard calls in, we're going to take a break and hear what he has to say about what's going on, and we can also have some commentary here from our guests. Three of our guests here in Baltimore, and they know this issue intimately. But it's a huge thing, and we are also in touch with Marilyn Mosby's office, and hopefully I'll have her on the air here with us soon to talk about, now that the gag order is lifted, her perspective on all of this. We are joined by Dr. Margaret Flowers, organizer with Popular Resistance, co-director of itsoureconomy.us and co-host of Clearing the Fog radio show, and she's the Green Party candidate for the U.S. Senate here in Maryland, and Dr. Jared Ball, associate professor of media studies at Morgan State University, a host and producer with the Real News Network. You can follow him on Twitter at @IMixWhatILike. Bob Summerby is editor of the Daily Howler. And Imara Jones is host of The Last Sip, an upcoming news program that will be on Free Speech TV for millennials of color, now in development. And welcome, good to have the four of you with us.
Thank you for having us.
Great. And Imara, congratulations, by the way, on the new show. It's great.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It was very cool. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Email us, as I said, at talk@steinershow.org. But do call in at 410-319-8888. And the topic of today's conversation really is where this election's going in terms of what a response should be from people in the progressive and left communities. Is it important to stop Donald Trump? Some people it makes no difference whether it's Trump or Hillary Clinton. And it really is a conversation that we need to have more and more of where we are going and where Donald Trump is taking us. Before we get to that, let me just ask very quickly, Jared, are you there? You with us, Jared?
I am, and happy to be here.
Always good to have you with us, brother. Glad you could make it.
Thank you.
So very quickly, can I just get your quick commentary on this dropping of charges?
Well, I think, unfortunately, it was predictable, and I think looking back that those of us who were suspicious of this were unfortunately correct, that the effect of the initial statement and list of charges from Mosby was more about quelling dissent in the streets and creating calm, and again reaffirming a whole coterie and establishment of leadership that I think is illegitimate, than it was about bringing about justice. And as we watched the trials unfold and the way evidence was delivered or not delivered and argued or not argued, it was. Unfortunately, clear that whatever people thought about justice was not going to occur. So I just think, again, that people will look at this as motivation to be better organized and committed, to look past events and event planning, and to real offline, off-the-record organization and movement building to really address these concerns, because clearly the people, whether it's the elections, which I know we're going to talk to in a moment,
yes,
or justice in the courts, the people don't really have adequate or any representation.
So we will get to that, and I just want to say that my partner and wife just texted me in saying that Marilyn Mosby I made a misstatement last hour. Marilyn Mosby just said at her press conference that she or her office were sued. And so I just want to let you all know that, and we'll be covering that. And we will take a break if we get a call in here from Baynard Woods, who is covering this for the Guardian newspaper, to hear what to give us an update on what was said by Marilyn Mosby at the site of where Freddie Gray was arrested, where she is holding a press conference. Also, the defense attorneys are holding a press conference as well. And we will get into this in some detail tomorrow. So this all does speak in some ways to where we are going here nationally in this election. One of the things that happened last night, the mothers of many of the people who were killed by the police, murdered by the police, spoke at the convention. Tamir Rice's mom didn't come because she took a more revolutionary stand, saying that this whole system has to be redone, and she didn't come. But the others did come. And it was an interesting juxtaposition to what you watched, I think, at the Republican convention, where Blue Lives Matter was the chant, and it was cheered when people got off, and Black Lives Matter was condemned at that convention, which is an interesting kind of real juxtaposition, I think, of attitudes about where our society is. So what does that say about where we think we are going politically? And Amari, let me start with you.
Well, I think that we are politically where we have been, and that is a growing divergence between the people that believe that there has to be serious reform amongst the police and those who feel that the police are there to protect them and that any reform is a threat to the protection that they feel that they both need and receive. And that has deep roots in race. It has deep roots in geography. It has deep roots in terms of the type of situations in which we live, whether or not they're urban or suburban. And one of the hallmarks of American life is the fact that, over the past 40 years, ironically, we've become more segregated in terms of the schools. Schools are more segregated than they've been in the last 50 years. Communities over the past 30 years have been resegregating. And there's a new report that says that 90% of white people in this country don't have any people of color as friends. And so if there's no dialogue, if there's no communication about these different experiences, then that means that those positions and experiences get hardened and calcified and that they're going to manifest politically and that that's what's happening.
So, Margaret Flowers, I mean, let's just get into the heart of this thing and then again, and introduce Bob Somerville back to the panel here. We know that you are in Philly and the Green Party has been outside having their own rallies. But when you watch what happens inside the Democratic Convention and you watch what's happening inside the Republican Convention, what is the argument that there's no difference between Republicans and Democrats and what they stand for?
I think that we're in a really interesting time right now, and I think that things are in a very different place from where they've been, although they've been leading in this direction. We're now seeing that in the United States, the Republican and Democratic parties have become minority parties. More people are registered as independents or third party than they are Democrats or Republicans, and more people are seeing that, you know, when you step back in the bigger picture on foreign policy, on many domestic policies, not talking about social policies, but economic policies, civil liberties, those kinds of things, that there really is not much difference between the two, you know, corporate parties, the Democrats and Republicans. And what's interesting here in Philly is there's both inside and outside the convention, there's quite a lot of energy inside. We see the Bernie Sanders delegates booing, holding up signs when they're not supposed to, having representatives of the DNC try to rip signs out of their hands, people walking out. And outside in the street, there's tremendous marches of thousands and thousands of people. We've been marching every day outside with thousands of people that are chanting, you know, hey, hey, DNC, you know, we won't vote for Hillary. It's time for Stein, Jill, not Hill. People are just, I think, and especially with the emails coming out, showing the corruption and how the whole Democratic primary process was rigged in favor of Hillary Clinton, has just exposed kind of what, you know, the practices of these two parties have been for decades. And so, in terms of the things that, you know, Amara said about racism, that's an incredibly important issue. But I think we can't talk about racism in this country without talking about the systemic problems that create greater wealth inequality and other disparities. And those are tied to the neoliberal economic policies that we've seen from the Democratic Party and supported by the Republicans for decades now. So, you know, that's why we say that, you know, we can't continue down this same path of electing more Democrats or Republicans. We have to build an alternative party that reflects the values of the movement. And that's hard work. It takes time. It may not win the first time, but we have to work to build that. That's how social transformation occurs in this country and has throughout history.
Bob Somerby.
Well, I think the most striking thing about this election is it represents the candidacy of Donald Trump represents the complete breakdown of the American public discourse. I mean, as recently as 16 years ago, you had an election between Gore and Bush with Nader running a third-party campaign. There were coherent differences between the candidates, which were actually discussed. There was a lot of nonsense in the discussion in campaign 2000, but there were coherent differences. 8 years ago, you had three Democratic candidates, all of whom were major candidates, all of whom were running on a health care proposal. This year, one of whom was candidate Clinton. This year, candidate Clinton seems to have no proposals that anyone has ever discussed, and candidate Trump seems to be frankly mentally ill. I mean, I think a discussion of him starts with the question, is he diagnosable in some way? And the problem I see, I write about the press corps, the problem I see, Trumpism, the press has had a very hard time dealing with Trump because he basically just does what they've been doing for the last 20 years. Trumpism is mainstream pressism. His complete disregard for accuracy has been matched by, and his fondness for lunacy has been matched by the press during the whole term of the last 25 years, let's say. And it just represents the total breakdown in anything resembling a coherent discussion. I don't see how it can be repaired. I just don't see a fix on the horizon.
So, Jared Ball, both as a media person and also as a radical thinker and political figure in our world, I'd like you to comment on what Bob said about the media and how they're handling this with Trump and the press, but also get into the question that I think is at the bottom of all this for many people. Is Donald Trump so dangerous to the future of our country and humanity that people have to vote for Hillary Clinton?
Well, I certainly don't think so. In fact, I'm as moved by those who make the argument that Hillary Clinton is as much a danger to world safety as anybody else. But I'm not cowed or at all being shocked by the claims that Trump is something new and a force so terrifying that we have to vote for somebody who is ultimately just as bad in terms of foreign policy and her impact on the economy, her goals, her neoliberal goals for the economy, for immigration, and certainly for the income and incarceration of so-called people of color. So I'm not moved in that way at all. In terms of media, I think mainstream media are, of course, complicit in creating conditions that would allow for a Trump to emerge. And to thrive. So any attempt there by them or anyone else to now look critically at Trump or what has happened with the Republican Party or politics in general would have to start with a critique of themselves. But my actual concern, even going to something that Dr. Flowers was talking about, is more about what purports to be the alternative and the left. Those are the spaces in which I intend to work and am only interested in working. And it's there that I find a lot of the same problems. So, for instance, I think that in what calls itself left and alternative media, including media I have worked with and work with now and have been even in leadership of in other cases, have not done an adequate job of making space for discussions of radical alternatives in terms of the use of the vote or an economy. We have not done enough to teach people about what, for instance, socialism really is and have allowed Bernie Sanders to take credit for nominally defining that for a country in ways that I think he has not done and actually, I think, done a disservice to the concept. And I think in terms of even electoral politics, for instance, I'm aware of what's going on in Philly this week within the Green Party and its own struggles around race and inclusiveness that are concerning. So I think, you know, when I start to look at a critique of how we got to the point we're in now with Trump and Hillary and all of that, my critique starts with myself and my own colleagues and comrades. We have not done enough to expand our base, to work together, to promote really radical alternatives, and are left now with many on the so-called left saying we have to vote for Hillary to prevent something worse. Well, that's what has always been said and is what has always led us to this position now. And then again, with those of us who are within this, who are nominally at least, claiming to be among the left and the alternative, we have really got to do better in terms of our own approach to our organization and dealing with race and inclusiveness within our own movement.
Amari, let me let you respond, and I'm going to hear from the other guests as well.
There's so much to respond to, some of which I agree with, a lot of which I disagree with. With the risk of being impertinent, I actually think that the claims that there's no difference between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are just patently ridiculous. They may be on some issues that people care about deeply, but I think for people that either fear mass deportation or have family members that will not be able to enter the country or that live in communities where he has promised to basically unchain the police. So to the extent that we know and believe that police brutality or misconduct, if you want to be polite about it, is already a severe problem in our communities, leading to unnecessary deaths and arrests and ruined lives by the hundreds of thousands and the millions of people that are incarcerated, that's going to get a lot worse. And so what I have found amongst a lot of progressives of color and the people that I talk to have been divided in this election between support for Hillary and support for Bernie, but have become really disturbed by what they have seen during the convention. The seeming total willingness of people who say that they support Bernie Sanders' agenda of transformation in America being willing to either overtly or not so overtly have a willingness to allow Donald Trump to be president. And a lot of those people feel that many of the people that are protesting aren't going to bear the consequences of a Trump presidency in the most severe ways. And so I just want to put that out there, that I think that that's something that is real and something that we should talk about. And I think much more broadly, the presidency is not a place for change. It just isn't. It is an institution that is about managing all of the various pressures that are in the United States that are mostly center, at the same time very conservative, with a push from the left and trying to balance those. And it either is going to go center right or center left mostly. It's not going to move that much because it's the apex of a pyramid. Where changes always happen in the United States is from the bottom up. You know, Franklin Roosevelt moved on the New Deal because there were socialists being elected at the local level all across the country, that they were taking over city councils, and there was a real fear that there was going to be a large socialist, if not communist, movement across the United States. And so that then pushed President Roosevelt to move in a certain way. And I think that we need to realize the same is true for the reasons why the Whig Party split. And if you look at the history of the way in which Abraham Lincoln moved from supporting slavery where it existed to abolishing slavery, is the same conversation about a bottom-up movement of change. And so if we really want to have change in the United States, the presidency is not where it is. It's not going to happen there. It's going to happen by electing Greens and alternative candidates on city councils and in state legislatures and all the boring, really hard, really annoying work of trying to scrounge up 5,000 or 6,000 votes in an off-year election in a state legislature seat in Maryland or in New York or in other places. That's where change happens. It's not going to be in the presidency. And so to say that we're willing to fall on our swords for an institution for change in an institution that is just not going to happen, I think is highly reckless and really irresponsible, particularly when we're facing someone like Donald Trump, who is not a traditional candidate, who is not someone that we should treat as if he is just you know, another, quote, corporate candidate, close quote. He is not. He is a threat to American democracy. Anything that you care about, if you care about freedom of speech, if you care about press freedom, if you care about the basic application of fundamental human rights in this country, that's what's on the line. And this concern about other things, such as, you know, Elijah Cummings is up there talking about his sharecropping parents, and is talking about immigration, and is talking about police brutality, and is interrupted by calls of no PP. There's a fundamental disconnect in terms of who's going to bear the brunt of a Trump presidency, and others who still care about things that are just, quite frankly, secondary to these fundamental issues of life and death and fundamental issues of freedom and democracy that are at stake in this election.
Margaret, you want to jump in here before we go to break and before I can bring Bob back in?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Again, there's so much to respond to. I don't think that anybody is trying to argue that there are no differences between Trump and Clinton. I think what we're seeing here in having the two most disliked presidential candidates that we've ever had in our history is a result of lesser evil voting that's been going on for decades. And while I agree with Bob that Trump may not be mentally fit to serve as president, the things that we're afraid of Trump doing are things that we've already seen coming out of the, you know, Clintons as well as Obama, you know, mass deportations, war on people of color around the world. Let's look at Libya. Let's look at what the Clintons have done in Haiti. You know, the assaults on civil liberties, crackdown on whistleblowers, economic policies. They've delivered on all of these things already. And so what we're in right now and in this moment is a struggle between the people and what the people need and the rich, the wealthy interests that control our political process. And I see this as a fundamental struggle, and there's no way that we're going to change, you know, the dynamics of that struggle by continuing to vote for these oligarchic plutocratic parties. So that's why it's so critical that we build the alternative. And right now on the left, the Green Party has the greatest infrastructure, but the Greens are also working with people in socialist parties, Socialist Alternative, ISO, and working to build, you know, what is going to be that alternative on the left that really is a party of the people. I just have to go with, you know, my friends Cornel West and Chris Hedges, who were here marching with us recently, that, you know, we have to build this alternative. It's a key point, part of the movement. The movement is critical, but you also have to have an electoral arm that can articulate what the movement is talking about and represent that. And that's what the Green Party is about. We're also running candidates at the local and federal level. And so especially in Baltimore, I think people should definitely check out the Baltimore Green Party to see the exciting candidates that we have there. And I'm going to stop because I know you want to take a break.
So we do have to get a short break and come right back. And we're going to jump into it. I really do want to explore this question of that I think the juxtapose really glaringly between what Amare just said and Marco just said, and Jared, about the dangers of somebody like Donald Trump, what that means for America if he's elected, and is there a difference? And also, if power does come from the bottom, how do you build a movement from the bottom that actually makes things change, that forces whoever's in the White House to make the moves that have to be made for our country? I know many people here in the panel would love to see capitalism overthrown, but I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow morning. So what do we do about that? We'll be right back. Mark Steiner here with Dr. Margaret Flowers, who is running to become the U.S. Senator from Maryland on the Green Party ticket. Dr. Jared Ball, an associate professor of media studies here at Morgan State University. Check him out on Twitter. I Mix What I Like, and he now hosts and produces a program on the Real News Network. Amare Jones, who now will be host of The Last Sip, an upcoming news program on Free Speech TV for millennials of color, which is now in development. We're looking forward to hearing what that's going to be like, or seeing. Not just hearing. And Bob Sornaby, editor of the Daily Howler, and you at 410-319-8888. Clarence, we're going to come to your call. Clarence and Leon, we're going to get to your thoughts. But Bob.
Well, I'll just go back to the question you asked about Trump. Is he so dangerous? The progressives should feel they have to vote for Clinton. It's an interesting question because there is basically no way to know how dangerous is this. This person is so far off the charts of any predictable prior candidacy. There's just no way of knowing what he would do if he was elected, including might he quit the next day. Ross Perot quit halfway through his campaign. He was ahead and he quit. You know, these and Perot was like a giant of sanity compared to Trump. Trump is a very, very strange person. So the question of is he dangerous and how dangerous is he and is he as bad as Clinton? There's no way to tell what he would do if he woke up on January 20th and he was sitting in the White House next year. There is no way of and he seems to be not particularly well, I'd have to say. He doesn't seem to be well. He's not a well man.
So, Jared, let me come back here. I mean, I think this is a real dilemma for a lot of people. I understand, I mean, the position that you're taking, and you and I have gone back and forth and written back and forth a great deal on Facebook and just between us around different issues. And I was thinking about what Margaret Flowers was saying and also what Amari was saying earlier about the change comes from the bottom and the power of change forces people who are at the top of this established capitalist system in the presidency to make changes because they're forced to make changes. And when you look at somebody like Donald Trump, you can look at somebody who is a blatant racist, somebody who is, and I think I agree with Bob, kind of mentally unbalanced, who's now potentially the United States president of this country.
The Moscovian candidate.
And the Moscovian candidate. So, I mean, and many of the forces that you would not consider on the left, but who are progressive in this country, representing communities of color and women and other people who are struggling are inside this established Democratic Party. Would have a different kind of force and push if their candidate was elected. I mean there's a big disconnect, I think, Jared, for people that think that Donald Trump would not make a difference as president of the United States.
Well, like Dr. Flower said earlier, nobody's saying that there's no difference between Hillary and Trump or the Democrats and Republicans. What I'm saying is that the difference has become indistinguishable to the point that a lot of people are looking for alternatives, rightly so, or are just dropping out entirely, again, understandably. But, and my point is that if the Democratic Party was to be something of a genuine alternative, it would have become one by now. And we've been hearing Malcolm X said a long time ago, it's the fox and the wolf. And, you know, the Democrats are the foxes and the Republicans are the wolves. They both are going to eat you. One is just a little more friendly about it in the process. Now, I get and then we look today and we look at what WikiLeaks thankfully provided for us, which is just more concrete evidence that the Democratic Party and its leadership is clear in what its mission is. And it is to cannibalize any internal radical threat that might emerge from within it. And Bernie did exactly what Bruce Dixon at Black Agenda Report predicted he was going to do, sheepdogged and shepherded a whole bunch of well-meaning people right back into the party. And thankfully, a bunch of them have walked out and raised a little bit of a fuss. But my point being is that if we want, and I agree, to the extent that change requires a grassroots bottom-up effort, that's what I'm advocating. My point is if we're going to have that grassroots radical impact on the top, so to speak, we have to be more organized and we have to be more committed to doing things that are not sanctioned by those in power. And I think in this part, it is to create alternative electoral options. By the way, you know, the example of FDR and the socialists, that it speaks exactly to my point. It was the committed organization of people at the bottom and in the streets to a socialist idea and the principles of socialism that forced the little bit of what are ultimately a concession from FDR. That movement was then repressed, much like the black radical elements and COINTELPRO operations and all of that, to the point where now we have to rebuild that genuine grassroots alternative effort. And I think to the extent that there are people who continue to say that I am pragmatically choosing Hillary, even though I know she's not the option, or I'm pragmatically choosing the Democrats, even though I know they're not the option, that these are the people that have to if not this November, I'm at least inviting them to join us after November to start really building the alternatives instead of telling us, as Ben Jealous foolishly did against Jill Stein the other day, that, well, you guys just pop up when it's, you know, the presidential campaign and you don't do anything in the interim. A, that's false, and B, to the extent that it's true, we want people more like him who claim to be on the left to get involved and help build those alternatives. And that's why I was saying earlier, we need media outlets to not just at the presidential election time, but throughout, to give voice and space to these and encouragement to these kinds of efforts so that we can have a greater impact coming from the bottom.
So I got a message from Valerie, my Valerie, who just wrote this in, and I want to share it with everybody. And Amara, we can come back to our guests and respond to this in this discussion about where people should go. It is true that we've always had a lesser of two evils voting and are faced with two capitalist corporate candidates. However, Donald Trump has unleashed something in white racists, whereas I think that now it is okay, they think now it is okay to act upon their racism. This is a dangerous reality that I haven't seen present as widely and deeply in my life. I'm not willing to gamble with the lives of my black, brown, and Muslim friends. Amari?
Yeah, I mean, can she tweet that out? I think that's essentially my point. There's a lot of what Jared said that I agree with, like 85% of it. And I think that that actually is the larger conversation. But I think that for this election and for the presidency, right? The presidency is a very different office. It's a very different institution. There are pressures and limitations on it that are going to constrain it. If Bernie Sanders had become president, he would have faced those same pressures and would have disappointed. And that's why, quite frankly, every president that gets elected disappoints, because there are a lot of limitations given the pressure on the system, both through lobbyists that we can talk about, and the way that the Constitution dissolves power throughout, where there are limitations. And so every president disappoints. That's just the system that we have, and there are very severe limitations. But I think that for the presidency to introduce someone who quite literally has no respect for the rule of law, no respect for decorum, is willing to say and to do things that are, if not fascist, are clearly proto-fascist, is a different element. That's totally different from having a standard politician, which to me Hillary Clinton is. She is a standard politician, and we actually know how to deal with standard politicians. We know how to pressure them. We know where their weaknesses are. We know how to move them or not move them. Those pressures built up on Obama and moved him in his last 2 years in particular to a much more progressive agenda, which has helped fuel his rise in the polls. So we know how to deal with a person like that. And we know how to deal with a person like Hillary Clinton, because actually where she started in social justice is in a place that is in a place of similar values. Now, there's been a long career, but you know, the fact that she went and infiltrated segregated schools, the fact that she went and infiltrated as well prisons and all of the rest of it, as a young person in her 20s, that's a totally different type of person than Donald Trump. And even if that person is in the system and has changed and faces all the pressures and all the, and made, has made all the compromises, we know how to deal with her. She's a known quantity. But to go with someone who quite clearly is a break with anything that we've known so far, and that threatens and has articulated things and has said that he will do things that will fundamentally tip over any amount of progress that we've ever think that we've made, to me is frightening. So, and I know a lot of my friends whose children are frightened and who have go to schools that are supposedly progressive or in liberal neighborhoods, and kids say, oh, you're going to be deported, oh, you're going to be this. And I'm sorry, I'm not willing to risk that. And let me just say one other thing really quickly that I think is important. You know, same thing with Dr. Flowers. You know, I agree with her on economic stuff a great deal and respect her work a great deal. But one of the things that she just said a minute ago was that we're facing everything that Donald Trump would do under Barack Obama. And so essentially the argument is that Barack Obama as president is the same thing as Donald Trump as president. And I just want to let that sit for a minute, because I don't think that there's anyone within the sound of my voice, or very few people, who actually believe that, who know that there's very little between them that is similar.
So
now, and I'll just stop there.
Yeah, I'm just saying, we have about 9 minutes left. I want to get a chance where I get back in here. And Mark, could you recall? Let me go to you and then go back over to Bob. Margaret?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear. Okay. Yeah, again, I'm not defending Trump in any way or saying that I support a Trump presidency, but I think that to say that Hillary Clinton has any respect for the rule of law is not to look at what the, you know, current situation is. Did she respect the rule of law in Ukraine when she helped with the coup that happened there? Did she respect the rule of law with what happened, you know, with her email scandal, with her foundation and weapons sales and the donations that have come into the Clinton Foundation from these major weapons manufacturers? I don't think that we can say that Clinton has any respect for the rule of law. No matter who she was in her 20s, it's pretty clear right now that she is the candidate of war and Wall Street. If a Trump is elected, and I don't think that's very likely, just looking at the Electoral College, almost every state is a safe state for the Democrats. He's going to be a weak president. The Democrats are against him. His own party doesn't like him. He will foment a greater popular movement. If Clinton is elected, she's going to be a strong president, and she's going to be able to push through her agenda, which is, again, let's look back at what the Clinton agenda has been. It's not going to solve the major crises that we're facing. And then on top of that, she's trying to instigate, you know, more aggression towards Russia. So where does that take us? And, you know, in terms of President Obama, I'm not saying that he's similar to Trump, but let's look at what he's done through kind of his, you know, his presidency. I mean, one of his major projects has been the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is going to overrule every progress that we've made on every front, whether it's economic, racial, or environmental justice. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is going to supersede our own Supreme Court and allow corporations to prevent us from making laws to protect our communities. And in Baltimore, we know what NAFTA did and who got hurt the most from that. So the point is that we need to build a progressive movement. We need to build progressive power. We don't do that by voting for Wall Street candidates. We do that by voting for third-party candidates, not being complicit with the Wall Street agenda, and then also having arm-in-arm with that, a strong movement, so that no matter who is elected, we are going to have to be out there demanding that the people are the ones to set the agenda, and we can no longer allow the ruling elite to be the ones that set the agenda.
Bob, I'll jump in here. Matthew Loft just tweeted in, I voted for Bernie, will be casting my vote in November for the American Solidarity Party, committed to justice for the poor.
Yeah, Bob. Well, I have to say just a minor point. I think it's very unlikely that Hillary Clinton will be a strong president, at least in any domestic policies, because I think she'll be unable to do anything. I think the current complete meltdown in Congress will just be be heightened at that point. So that's an aside. You know, I'm very much in favor of movement building. Boy, do we need movement building, and do we need clarity building. We need a lot of building. I'm sort of opposed to the idea that movement building has to work through feudal presidential campaigns. Presidential campaigns that aren't going to produce a winner. I told Mark earlier, he disagrees with me on one point of this. Ralph Nader was a gigantic achiever when he wasn't a presidential candidate. And when he was a presidential candidate, I think it's quite it's arguable that what he achieved was getting President Bush elected. Now, that, Mark, I think, doesn't necessarily agree with that.
Yeah, that's not important right now.
But I mean, in the last 20 years or so, there's been a move toward movement building working through feudal presidential campaigns. I just don't think that's the way successful movements get built, and I don't see the logic of building movements that way. And it may be that a person feels there's no difference between Trump or Clinton, and what difference does it make? But it seems to me that's a one-day vote. You might as well make a decision based on whether you think there's a difference. And movement building has to go on the other 3 years of the four-year cycle, not through a feudal election campaign.
So, can I respond to the Nader thing very quickly?
And then I'm going to hear from Jared. I'm going to get a phone call in here. We only have like 4 minutes left, and I'm going to hear. Go ahead.
Just quickly, the Democratic Party has put out there that this myth that Nader was the one that spoiled the election in 2000, and that's been proven to be false. It was Gore who lost his election. He ran a terrible campaign, and actually them, you know, and look at just one state, look at Florida, hundreds of thousands of liberal Democrats voted for Bush, whereas only tens of thousands voted for Nader. So it was clearly, you know, we have to, it's dangerous to blame Nader, because the reason Gore lost the election is that he was a candidate, a neoliberal, third way Democrat, a warmonger, and ever since then, the Democrats have run the same MO, and it's the same thing over again. They haven't learned the lesson, and they're the ones that should be taking the responsibility for losing that election.
Yeah, I'm not blaming Nader, and I have a lot of respect for Nader, but I think it's certainly possible that if Nader had not run in that election, that Gore would have won.
I don't think it's down to him.
I mean, if Gore had won Tennessee, he wouldn't have to worry about Florida. He couldn't even win his own state.
Well, that was the NRA. Come on.
I'm just saying, Jared, if
Nader hadn't run, it's entirely possible that Gore would have won.
Both positions are very...
That doesn't bear out in the fact
that
the CNN poll showed that Gore would have done worse if Nader hadn't run.
Both positions are arguable, and I don't know who's going to resolve that. But, Jared, we only have a couple minutes left. Let me let you get a thought here. I'm sorry. Go.
Well, 2 minutes. I've got to say that I think the research of Harvey Wasserman and Bob Fratakis shows that both of my guests, my colleagues, their arguments are secondary to the fact that 2000 and 2004 were stolen. And that's an issue that has not even come up again now, even as Hillary brought it up when she was running against Obama in 08. So I think that's, but my point again is I am not advocating, I want to be very clear, I'm not saying there are no differences between Trump and Clinton. I'm saying that those of us who are advocating a break with both those parties are responding to and recognizing the long history of the Democratic Party abandoning people when it came down to issues and defending the rights of people here and abroad and standing on platforms that most of us actually want and that we need to develop alternatives. I'm not arguing that we only do this around presidential elections. In fact, my entire argument is that the vote is only just the first psychological break with the state and the system as it's currently set up, and that the rest of the work does have to occur offline, off air, in real organized social movement building. It is the Democratic Party that invites people to only participate once every 4 years, maybe every two at the most. And it is they who use the election cycles as a moment to build their movement. And every other moment, they are abandoning the people who they bring in just for these cycles. And I'm advocating a total break with that entire process, starting with just the simple fact, the simple, very legal and easy switching of parties, party affiliations, and voting, in this case, either with Jill Stein or maybe Eugene Puryear and Gloria LaRiva with the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and then help build those as movements that representing the politics represented in those party platforms in the interim and intervening years and at all times going forward.
So we're close to being out of time. We've got to jump into our segment on the city paper here in just a minute. I want to thank the four of you. This has been really a fascinating conversation. I really want to reconvene this for even more discussion and more depth with you and others around where progressive and movements go in this country, how you respond to this election, and where we're going. Four really committed and interesting people here on our panel today. You just heard Dr. Jared Ball, who's Associate Professor of Media Studies at Morgan State University and host and producer of a program at the Real News Network. And you can follow him on Twitter at @IMixWhatILike. Dr. Margaret Flowers is organizer with Popular Resistance, co-director of itsoureconomy.us, and Green Party candidate for U.S. Senate here in Maryland. Imara Jones, who will be host of The Last Sip, an upcoming news program at Free Speech TV for millennials of color, now in development. And as I said before, we're really excited about that. Bob Sorenby, editor of The Daily Howler, and have been a commentator on this program since its inception, really. So thank the four of you so much for taking your time with us today.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you all. We're going to take a short break and come back. We're seeing what's happening in the city paper. They're in Philly. We'll have what's happening in their paper while they're in Philly.